Good morning, Your Honors. Ina Lipkin on behalf of the petitioner. This is a case where the court ordered the petitioner to submit a brief explaining why the court would have jurisdiction. The issue here is whether he filed his motion for stay before the Ninth Circuit in a timely manner. The Board of Immigration Appeals initially denied the case on October the 7th, 2003, and petitioner did not receive notice upon receiving what is called a bag and baggage order indicating that he should appear for deportation. His attorney called the Board of Appeals, asked whether a decision had been issued. Requested that the BIA check whether, in fact, a decision was mailed. When he learned that it was, he promptly filed a motion to reopen and a request to reissue a new decision. A decision was issued on April 28th, 04. However, that decision denied the petitioner's request to reissue the decision.
On the ground that it was mailed, or that the record reflects that it was mailed to the right address.
Yes, that's what the BIA asserted. However, there's nothing.
Is there anything in the record to indicate mailing?
You know, Your Honor, there isn't anything in this administrative record. There's nothing to show that a letter was mailed and then returned as undelivered, and alternatively, there's nothing to show that it was mailed certified a return receipt.
The BIA decision states that the record reflects that notice was sent to the attorney. Do you have any idea what that refers to?
I don't, and that's one of the points that we argued in our brief, that there really isn't anything in the administrative record to buttress that assertion by the board. Furthermore, the petitioner and his attorney of record complied with case law and with the BIA's own precedent in the matter of In re Grijalva 21, INN Decision 27, BIA 1995, the board said that although a presumption exists that postal employees would discharge their duties and send the mail, that presumption can be overcome. And the petitioner has done that by himself writing a affidavit under penalty of perjury, and so has his attorney. Furthermore,
why does that overcome the presumption?
Well,
why does that necessarily overcome the presumption?
It shows that the petitioner and his attorney of record have complied with regulation and have done.
How do we know they're telling the truth?
Well, the attorney is an officer of the court, has taken an oath to uphold the law.
Being lawyers never lie?
Well, Your Honor, I can't speak about
that. In law that if a lawyer says it, it must be true?
Well, Your Honor, I feel that looking at the facts of this case.
Well, but there are no facts. I mean, the fact is your client, I mean, the lawyer and the client have filed affidavits. Sometimes affidavits are true, sometimes they're false. We don't know whether that's true or false. How is that determined?
Well,
do we say whenever client and lawyer file an affidavit, that's conclusive? I mean, how is that resolved?
I won't even answer that. I will instead point to the fact that
I really wish you would answer it.
All right, Your Honor. Well, here the petitioner has always appeared at every individual hearing set by the immigration judge.
I think
judge.
This is good for the trier of fact. I think these are reasons why the trier of fact, or somebody considering the truth of this, might believe it.
But
we don't have a determination. All we have is claims. And how is that resolved? How do we know whether the for that matter, how do we know whether the BIA is right when it says it mailed?
Right. Well, I think in the case of the petitioner, he has always acted in good faith, and he has always shown a desire to pursue his asylum application. He himself voluntarily applied.
So the next time Flakey loses?
Well, Your Honors, I don't think that it showed that.
I mean, do we make this determination? Do we decide, oh, you know, this guy looks really reliable, so we believe him?
I haven't done
that since my last trial, you know.
I understand. I think that had the petitioner not actively pursued his appeal, not timely filed it after being verbally told by the immigration judge.
What would you like us to do? Maybe that would help answer the question. Would you like us to decide this?
I think that
this record, or do you think there's some other option?
I think that it's true that this record doesn't have too much evidence to show whether the BIA mailed something to the petitioner's attorney of record or not. I think that it would be wise to remand it to the board and request that the board submit some evidence if they keep such records that they mailed the decision, or if they have a record.
BIA could establish that they put it in the mail. Is that the end of the inquiry then?
Well, Your Honor,
notwithstanding that you say there are two affidavits under penalty of perjury, that they, notwithstanding it was put in the mail, or was it received?
But, Your Honors, the fact that it was not mailed certified mail.
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to understand the construct we've got here. The Congress eliminated certified mail, and as we noted in SALTA, that changes the regime a bit. So I think at least what I'm searching for is what is the construct that you, as on sitting on the recipient side, believe ought to be the rule if the BIA is going to establish some kind of rule? Is it that it's enough for the BIA to make a record that they, you know, take a videotape, here's going in the mail, okay? And then if the petitioner doesn't get it and files office manager of the law firm, the attorney, the petitioner himself, all say, we never got it. Is that, they're just out of luck?
I think that would place that would be an unfair result to do that. Certainly the U.S. mail is known for delivering in all weather and all conditions, as we know from commercials and so forth. But it's also very reasonable to understand that not every piece of mail is going to reach its destination. And I think if an attorney is...
I think you've answered Judge Fischer's question. Mm-hmm. Okay? I mean, you're sort of talking, but you're not answering the question. What would you like us to do? What do we do in this situation? Okay, let me give you a list of options, okay? We could simply deny the petition, dismiss, okay? I don't think you'd like that one, okay? We could appoint a master to take evidence and weigh whether your clients are truthful or weigh whether or not, could look into the facts. We could remand to the board for a factual determination. We could simply deem it conclusively established that there was no receipt and therefore order the BIA to reissue its order. Okay, those are the options that immediately come to mind. Now, without a disquisition, okay, is any of those options acceptable to you?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay. Just yes or no will do, okay?
Yes,
sir. Let's just keep it simple. Okay, which one of those?
I feel
which
that...
Which ones of those do you find acceptable? Which do you want us to do?
I feel that Your Honor should...
Just tell me which.
You should find that you have jurisdiction to review this petition and that the affidavits of the attorney and petitioner were sufficient evidence because they were under penalty of perjury to prove that they did not receive.
You want us to take them as true and order the BIA to reissue?
Yes, okay. Your Honor.
How do we know they're not lying?
Well, Your Honors.
What happens in the next case when there is no lawyer, when there is only a petitioner who is pro se and he files an affidavit and says, I didn't get it? Happens all the time. We get these things all the time. I never got it under penalty of perjury. Do we accept that as true as well?
Well, I can't speak for other cases, but I think if you look at the facts of this case.
I'm asking a hypothetical. This is how oral argument works.
I understand, Your Honor. I think that you have to look at the facts to see if a petitioner.
I just gave you the facts.
But you have to look whether a particular petitioner has tried to delay proceedings in the past and whether what other factors are.
So we make a factual determination. Some affidavits we believe and some we don't believe, depending on how we evaluate the record. So what you're doing is you're turning us into a trial court And we make the determination, I mean, do we bring the guy in and see whether he sweats when he testifies? You want us to be a trial court on a cold record, basically on an affidavit. We look at the record, we look at the affidavit, and see whether it's believable. That's what you want us to do?
I think part of the determination has to be based on the facts in the record.
So you would look at totality of circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor.
Kind of approach you're suggesting?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
And we do that?
Well,
I mean, that's what you're asking for. You see the problems with that? What would keep every petitioner who misses a deadline for filing an affidavit? I mean, they're going to get booted out of the country anyway if they lose. Not very good chance that the government will go after them for perjury on this. You know, they hardly ever do even when people perjure themselves in court. So they file an affidavit saying, I didn't get it. I mean, do you understand the implications of this?
I do understand the difficulty of the situation, but I feel that, especially in the facts of this case, I think that when someone is pursuing their appeal at every level, timely filing in the past, I think it goes to show that they're doing due diligence to pursue their appeal.
I didn't see the government invoke it at all, but there is an 800 number, in fact, that was called. Does the petitioner have any burden to check periodically, given that 800 number, to find out the status?
I think there is, you know, a reasonable expectation.
That's what
the
Seventh Circuit said in NOAC.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's what the Seventh Circuit said in NOAC.
Mm-hmm.
You familiar with NOAC?
Yes, Your Honor. But
the Polish guy?
But in this case, the petitioner.
Ordinance 94-Fed-3-390. Seventh Circuit said you call the number. You have doubts about whether the mails are working, you call the number. Is it, in fact, I don't know anything about calling the number. Is it hard to get through?
No, Your Honor.
Do you talk to a person? Is it automatic?
It's an automatic system, and you punch in numbers to find out the status of your case. But in this instance, the petitioner filed his appeal to the board in 2003, I think it was at the end of 2002. Let me check exactly. And almost less than a year later, the board made its decision, which is unusual. It usually takes longer. I think the fact that when he received the bag and baggage order, he immediately took action to find out why that this happened shows that he did.
If you look at NOAC, what they say is none of that really matters. I mean, we may have agree with the Seventh Circuit, but they say none of it really matters. The thing was issued, the time runs from issuance of the BIA's opinion, and if you have doubts about whether you, it's just like district court. We have a federal rule of procedure that says the fact that the clerk doesn't send out an order does not have any effect on the timing. People have a duty to check the docket. It's a harsh rule, but that's the rule in district court, and the Seventh Circuit at least said that's a rule applicable here, too. You or your lawyer, certainly a lawyer can have a paralegal every 25 days call and punch in the numbers for all the clients and their docket numbers, right?
Certainly, Your Honor, but that's not the rule here.
It wouldn't take very long. I mean, you know, it would be an expense of doing business, but it's not that hard to do, right? You could punch in a couple of hundred numbers in a matter of a couple of hours, you know, 2 hours, right?
That's true, Your Honor. However, it is the Board of Appeals' duty to timely issue a notice of their decision, and the petitioner and his attorney have a reliance that that's what the board will do, that they will timely issue it to them. I'm sure that
nothing in the Seventh Circuit. I mean,
I disagree with that rule.
If we say they can rely on it, then they can rely on it. If we say, I mean, we, the Court of Appeals in the particular circuit says they can't rely on it, then they can't rely on it. It's you know, just the way the rule works. Anyway, you've gone over your time. Why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Actually, we've gone over your time.
We never go over.
May it please the Court, Joan Smiley from the Department of Justice on behalf of the Attorney General.
Is that important to you to have to go to the Circuit Court of Appeals to get a decision when you could have just simply reissued the order under the facts of this case? I take it that you agree that the petitioner never received notice, that everything depends upon the fact that notice presumably was sent to the attorney, correct?
Yes, the record indicates that the decision was sent to the
attorney. I guess,
you
know, to follow the Seventh Circuit, the immigration attorneys, the first thing they should do in the morning.
Sorry, you said yes, but you actually answered yes to a different question. Your follow-up was to a different question than you were asked. Do you, I think Judge Block asked you, you agree that they got the notice? I'm sorry, you agree that they did not get the notice?
No, I don't.
It was sent to his attorney, presumably, correct?
Yes, on page 22 of the record, the cover sheet for the board's decision indicates that it was sent to the attorney of record at his address of record.
All right, so we are clear that it was not sent to the petitioner. Can we agree to that?
Yes.
All right. Now tell me what it is that you rely upon precisely to support the BIA's decision that the record reflects notice was sent to the attorney. The fact that the attorney's name was on the papers?
The attorney's name and correct address of record, the P.O. Box in Fremont, California, is indicated on the transmittal letter with the board decision. In addition, the board evaluated the evidence that was submitted with the motion to reissue the decision, which consisted of two declarations stating basically that they had not received.
When you speak of the transmittal letter, what precisely are you talking about?
On page 22 of the record, it's the transmittal letter that is the cover sheet that is included with the board's decision, which indicates the name and address to which it's directed, and it says enclosed is a copy of the board's decision of April 28th.
So that's basically what you rely upon as proof that the mailing was sent to the attorney.
Yes.
That's the entire reliance that you place upon that, correct? I just want to get that clarified.
And the only issue in the case is whether the board's denial to reissue its decision was an abuse of discretion, where, as I've indicated, the record indicates that the decision was sent to the correct address.
Before you get to that, I mean, what this letter tells us is that the board had the correct address.
Yes.
Right. Do we have any evidence as to the person who actually put it in the envelope and put a stamp on it?
Whether they typed
the envelope correctly?
There's a presumption of proper delivery that attaches to Postal Service mail. Here,
I'm going to ask you a question, and I would like an answer.
The letter.
Is there any evidence in the record about the envelope?
No, there isn't.
Okay. Is there any testimony, anything that anybody said, oh, yes, I remember this was the Singh, the Gallup Singh application. I remember stuffing the envelope, typing up the, or putting the right label on the envelope, putting a stamp.
Not, Your Honor.
Well, how then do we evaluate the board's finding that it was actually mailed? I mean, we do know people make mistakes. You may have made a mistake once or twice. I have.
Yes.
I know because the Supreme Court tells me every so often when I've made mistakes. So how do we know that the when it got to mailing this particular notice, the clerk that was in charge of it didn't sort of stuff it in the wrong envelope or forget to put a stamp on it or mistype the address. I don't know how the process works. I assume there's some automation, some automated aspect of the process, but how do we know any of those things? There wasn't a glitch in any of those processes?
Well, while we don't know the facts that Your Honor is requesting as this particular case is concerned, we know that it was prepared in the ordinary course of business, placed in the postal mail system, and as I've said, there's a presumption of proper delivery once it does enter the mail system.
But we've already said in Salta that, in the face of some contrary evidence, doesn't suffice.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
We've already said in Salta, in this circuit, that under the regular mail provisos, unlike the certified mail provisos, that that presumption doesn't necessarily overcome contrary evidence presented by the petitioner. And here, in fact, there was not just one affidavit, but two. In Salta, there wasn't even an affidavit. So what is the regime that the BIA thinks is proper to give notice?
If even under Salta, on page 1079 of that decision, this Court stated that it's still proper to presume that postal officers properly discharge their duties.
Yes, and then it goes on to say deliberately. It says, although it is still proper to presume, it says delivery by regular mail does not raise the same strong presumption as certified mail, and less should be required to rebut such a presumption. So it does contemplate that it's rebuttable. Now, what is it that a non-recipient is supposed to put forward to rebut beyond two affidavits from the two people who could logically have received it?
First of all,
under penalty of perjury.
Excuse me.
They're both under penalty of perjury, which wasn't present in Salta.
The facts in this case are very different from the facts in Salta. And in addition.
How so?
Well, in Salta, the board and the immigration judge had applied a very strict evidentiary requirement to the burden to establish the lack of notice. Here, the board did not do that.
It didn't do anything. It just said no.
It did. It evaluated the record before it, the evidence that was submitted by petitioner with his motion to reissue.
Where is that set forth? How do we know? What did it
says that the record reflects that, and that is the record that is before the board, the motion that the petitioner filed.
Well, how do we know the board isn't lying when it says that? I mean, usually when a district judge makes a finding, we don't just take his word for it, much as we may respect him and do respect him.
I do in the Second Circuit, though.
we usually see if there's evidence to support it. Now, if there's evidence going both ways, we give it to the, you know, the benefit of the doubt to the trier of fact. But how do we know that the board here even looked at the record? How do we review this determination by the board that says the record reflects X? I look at the record, as far as I have it, it reflects nothing of the sort. All it reflects is a piece of paper with an address on it. I have to fill in, you know, the thing about mailing is something that I have to imagine in my mind somebody actually doing. And as I'm sort of playing that little movie in my mind, I'm imagining all sorts of ways in which the process could go wrong. If it's I don't know if they type envelopes or whether it's a machine, but, you know, I've seen machines jam. I've seen printers run out of ink. I've seen stamp machines, you know, sort of get skewed, you know, so the stamp doesn't go in the right place or doesn't go in the envelope. I've seen all these things malfunction. And we know for a fact, if you get down the street, there was some case in the news recently about some post-delivery, some mailman who for years took mail home because he kept being overwhelmed by not being able to deliver all the stuff. So they found 10 years' worth of back mail in his house. Maybe even, no, not there, but, you know. So we do know. I mean, we do know. We've all lost pieces of mail, you know, things that have been mailed, that we know have been mailed, or that we've mailed and that have never gotten there. It's rare, but it does happen. How do we account for all that?
First of all, if an individual that has a removal proceeding that is ensuing has any doubts about the postal system, as in NOAC, they are free to call the BIA inquiry system and check periodically on the status.
Did you argue that in your brief?
Yes, we did indicate that in our brief.
So let me interrupt, if I may. So an immigration lawyer specializing in immigration, the first thing that person should do in the morning after he or she has a cup of coffee is to call the hotline to find out what's happening with this case.
Not necessarily.
That's what you're suggesting would have to happen.
As I believe Judge Kaczynski indicated, every 25 days, in other words, that would still give 5 days after a decision is issued. Here, the evidence shows that
he could do it 1/25th of his cases every day. No, I'm not joking. I'm saying if he has 200 cases, he could have a paralegal call four cases a day.
If someone does not trust that they are going to get notice through the ordinary course of business, that would be an option. Here, the attorney waited 18 days after he says that he found out. He found out, he says, on February 23rd, 2004, he waited 18 days to file a motion to reissue on March 12th.
Would it have made any difference if he'd waited 16 days or 12 days or he'd done it let's level with each other. It wouldn't have made any difference.
That the board evaluated.
Well, no, wait. I want to come back to that because I'm looking at what they say, and they say respondent has filed a motion to reissue the board's October 7, 2003 decision. The motion is denied as the record reflects that the respondent's decision was correctly mailed to the respondent's attorney of record. I have no knowledge from that statement whether the board looked at the declarations or anything. All it says is the record shows the fact that it was mailed. That's the same record that the BIA was relying upon in Salta. It was from the BIA, the board standpoint, we sent it out, so that's enough. And if is that the board's now official position, that so long as it's sent out in regular mail and the internal records at the board, in the clerk's office, show that it was put in the mail, it does not make any difference what the petitioner, who puts in two sworn affidavits and whatever else they may come up with, doesn't make any difference because the board's rule is we put it in the mail per whatever our records say. That's enough for the board, so it doesn't make a hoodoo difference.
No, it would make a difference.
Excuse me, I don't think if that's the position that that's consistent with Salta, as you suggest.
It would make a difference. It depends on the facts of the case.
Well, how do we know what the board did here?
The board indicates that it was sent to the correct address. If it hadn't looked at page 822, then I wouldn't know. If that page said it was sent to 708 Oak Street.
As Judge Kaczynski has posited, it was stamped in the clerk's office, but somewhere betwixt the stamping, which is all that's in the record, it's just a statement that looks like even by a stamp signature, that's all that's in the record that I see. That doesn't show what happened thereafter, whether it fell to the floor or whatever else. So does the board simply say it's enough for our process?
The board evaluates the record. Here, the statute provides written notice by regular mail, not certified.
That's
the law
it.
Was
so,
repealed in
96. So as long as there's a sheet of paper in the file in the board's offices, that is enough. And if the petitioner doesn't get it, they're out of luck, unless they call the 800 number.
Well, it depends.
That is the board,
that
is the government's position. That's the board's rule.
The government's position is that the board evaluates the factual record before
it. And all it cites in its one-line order is, or three-line order, is that it was put in the mail at the board. It doesn't say we don't believe attorneys commit perjury under oath. We believe that attorney affidavits are not worth the paper they're printed on. We don't believe affidavits under a penalty of perjury because, you know, they don't have anything at stake. We don't believe them because there's no objective evidence or special circumstances, anything to suggest that this one may have slipped through the mail. That's the board's rule. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm trying to understand here because we get, as Judge Kaczynski said, we get tons of these, and I'm sure that the board does too, where there may be a claim of non-receipt. So the board rule seems now to be it's enough if we put a piece of paper in somebody at the clerk's office puts a piece of paper in the file, and that's it. Because there's nothing on this record that one can extrapolate anything other than that. There's nothing here except some presumption that the board looks at the record, but there's nothing that's been articulated by the board that backs up what you
said. Well, the board says that the record reflects this. They didn't discuss each and every factor that
the record also reflects that the petitioner filed two sworn affidavits How do you know?
Because they say that the record reflects this.
Well, but see, that's the problem. The record doesn't reflect this, at least not the record we have. The record has nothing about the process of mailing. So they say it. If we take you at your word, then this would be a factual finding about what the record reflects that's not supported by the record, because there's nothing in the record. There's no affidavit from some employee of the INS that says, oh, yes, I remember mailing this. There's no notation in the docket sheet saying this was mailed to this address. There's nothing in the record other than a piece of paper with an address on it. So why isn't this a finding?
Transmittal letter, and that.
Sorry?
The transmittal letter is the proof of mailing in this case. Nothing more is required under the statute.
It's, to me,
1229A1 or under the regulation.
I'm sorry. Well, where is it? I mean, what I see at ER 22 or the record 22 is a piece of paper with an address on it.
All that is required under the statute and the regulation is service by regular mail.
How do we know it was served? How do we know it was actually put in the mail?
The presumption is that it was prepared in the ordinary course of business, placed in the postal service, and the vast majority of mail is...
Where does this presumption come from?
From the longstanding body of case law.
Give me a case.
It's noted in our brief.
But you
and
see,
even under
I'm sorry. Okay, why don't you get your brief and give me a case?
Even under SALTA.
Just give me a case.
SALTA.
Just give me a case.
SALTA.
No, SALTA is not a case that helps you.
I believe that SALTA does confirm that there is a presumption of delivery and that in this case, as I've indicated,
if you say that there's a presumption of delivery, are you not also saying that there could be circumstances where that presumption could be overcome? It seems to me that what you're saying is that the presumption never can be overcome. Or if you think it can, you tell me under what set of circumstances that presumption can be overcome.
Well, for instance, in SALTA, the presumption was overcome because there was evidence that the board and the immigration judge require too heavy of an evidentiary burden.
You know, you are misreading SALTA. What SALTA says, assuming you mailed it, there's a presumption of delivery. I'm dealing with a different part of the process. I'm dealing with the question, was it mailed? Yes, if it was mailed, if you have proof of mailing, then you've got some sort of presumption of delivery. But you want to say, we want to presume from a piece of paper, from the fact that there's a piece of paper in the record with the right address, that we, the BIA, actually performed all the functions that involved the mailing. Taking this piece of paper, put it in an envelope, addressed it properly, stamped it properly, put it in the U.S. mailbox. And the question is, where is the evidence that that happened, or where is the legal presumption that that happened in this case?
In this case, the board evaluated what was before it, reached that conclusion.
How do we review that?
Oh, it's an abuse of discretion standard of review, unless the board's action was arbitrary.
I thought it's a question of fact, which is reviewed for substantial evidence.
Or contrary to law.
No, I think not. It's a question of fact.
No, this is on a motion to reissue, which has been construed as a motion to reopen, which would be clearly a highly...
Why don't you let us decide the standard? Let's say we treat this as a question of fact. Where is the evidence?
Where is the evidence?
Yes.
The evidence would be the motion to reissue, the evidence submitted with it, and the board's decision.
There's nothing to tell us about whether what happened inside the board, whether they actually did the mailing. You know why it matters? Because our law is different from that of the Seventh Circuit. You're familiar with our case in Martinez-Serrano?
Yes,
well, that was a case that we said if it's mailed to the wrong address.
Right.
And what we held there is that interpreting the Supreme Court's opinion in, I think, Stone, what we said there was that Stone versus INS, an opinion isn't issued until it is properly mailed.
That is correct.
And so when it is not properly mailed, there is no issuance, and therefore no trigger date for the filing of a petition for review.
And unlike Martinez-Serrano, there the decision was not mailed to the address that had been submitted to it by the attorney 9 months prior. So they realized the mistake and resent the decision.
I do understand that.
Here, the board found that it was sent to the correct address.
But what happens, what Martinez-Serrano stands for, is that the mailing is what triggers, is what is the issuance date. And it seems to me that you have to have some proof as to the mailing, if that's the case. Otherwise, you don't have an issuance date.
The proof of by certified mail return receipt requested was eliminated in 1996. Therefore, everything
well, the
that
INS
in
doesn't,
this case
doesn't have to. I mean, the statute says they may. They need not use certified mail. It doesn't say they are prohibited from doing it.
No, but the requirement was repealed in 96. Here, the board clearly
the question
complied
is then,
who with
takes
the statute.
The, who takes the risk of a glitch?
Excuse me?
When you choose to make that switch, who takes the risk of a glitch? That's the problem. That's the question.
Here, Congress enacted a new statute. The board is following congressional intent, complying with the statute, promulgating regulations.
I'm sorry, the statute says it may not use certified mail?
No, the statute says that you can send it out to the attorney of record by regular mail.
Right, but it would not violate the statute to use
certified. It doesn't preclude certified, but it doesn't require it.
No, but
it just requires service
by mail.
Maybe
there may simply be consequences from not using certified mail, and, you know, it's up to the BIA whether it wishes to take the chance of those consequences.
What would be wrong with the BIA issuing a regulation or a rule or a guidance to say that our rules are that we are now using regular mail. We will rely on our own internal records, which in this case before us, the Ninth Circuit panel right now, appears to be simply a certification or a statement, a letter, which shows the correct address. It doesn't show the envelope. It doesn't show any declaration from the author of that letter that he actually caused it to be put in the mail, or there's nothing else, no evidentiary track to take it from the statement on that piece of paper, as would have occurred under a certified mail regime. So now, without that regime in place, the board is now content to say the risk of non-delivery is entirely on the recipient, and so long as the board records show it was supposedly addressed to the correct address, all risk is on the petitioner. So therefore, if you have any concerns about non-receipt, you have this 800 number to call. You should call it every 14 days or whatever, so that you may be aware in case of non-delivery. And then people are on notice that that burden is entirely on them, so they don't wait, as counsel in this case suggested, and which occurs to us as well, is that the backlog at getting decisions out, one can't infer from silence for several months that the board has acted, and I just haven't gotten it, so there's an assumed backlog on the part of the BIA, right? So why doesn't the board simply come up with that? I had a case where the board has encourages the petitioners to file their briefs using FedEx or DHL and the like, and tells them specifically so that they have a record as the sender of that when they deposit it with the delivery service. Now, the board used to have that obligation on its side of the obligation to get notices out when it used certified mail. That's all gone because you say Congress, as it did, gave that permission. So why is the board sort of playing this routine with people? I understand it has some concerns about petitioners falsifying statements of non-receipt. But what – I'm just at a loss to understand how the recipient should document that they didn't get it other than by saying, we didn't get it. It means that they're totally at risk. So shouldn't they know that? Why isn't the government looking at that?
The petitioner is at risk just as a party is at risk before this court. If there's an adverse decision.
Yeah, but they know that. And they know that. There's a rule out there. There are decisions out there. Where is the board statement to the.
There are all sorts of advisals every step of the way from the notice
what,
to
what
appear
are they advised,
forward.
What are they advised to do in this situation? Where, is there some board rule or some guidance on this one?
Well, the immigration judge, as well as the forms that are given to the alien, indicates what the rules and regulations that apply consist of.
What do they say about this? Do they say essentially what I suggested, which is
there are, they
you,
say
you need to check in if you don't hear because you've got an obligation that your time limit will run if you haven't moved properly.
No, they say that a decision will be mailed, and then there are 30 days thereafter to file.
So they're
file
relying
a
on them to come in the mail. That's the affirmative representation, and it doesn't show up in the mail. So
relying on
if they why can't they rely on the presumption as well of the post office carries out its form, and therefore until it does come in the mail, it hasn't been sent. See the dilemma? I mean, how does one know?
Well, how one knows is the board is. Has the full record before it in any given case, in this case and all others that come before it, and they evaluate it. If they are required to reissue a decision every time someone claims they didn't receive it, then it would be
that at all. That wasn't
very
what
easy.
That wasn't what I was suggesting at all. But okay. Thank
in
you.
This case, we would submit
I
that, the,
you listen, but that's all right.
That the board did not abuse its discretion.
All your time, I think.
Thank you.
Given us all we have to give. Anything further? Case is argued, stand submitted.